Good evening, friends. Thanks for tuning into Valley Writers Read. Our writer-reader tonight hails from Reedley, and believe me, you're not going to be disappointed in her story. This one is a winner. Here she is, Hope Knisley reading, With Normal in My Rearview Mirror.
With Normal in My Rearview Mirror. The day begins inauspiciously when Arjetta chooses what has to be one of the more inopportune moments imaginable to develop a short in the electrical system and honk madly, as if we are criminals trying to steal it. Because this happens in the parking lot of a state penitentiary, it is, to put it mildly, disconcerting if a bit ironic. The Jetta intermittently continued this particular, not-so-endearing quirk throughout our entire summer vacation, displaying itself in two ways. The first was like it did at the prison, honking when we locked the doors, creating the impression of burglary. The second manifestation would occur while we were barreling down the interstate at 75 miles per hour, when it would beep as if we had opened the door and left the key in the ignition. At that point, whichever one of us was the passenger would lean over and take control of the steering while the driver removed the cruise control and slowed down long enough to open and slam the door three or four times. When we were lucky, the first slam did the trick, but usually it took a few extra. All this was acceptable, if embarrassing, when it happened in the parking lot of Subway or Starbucks. It was a bit more problematic on the highway. In the prison parking lot, it was positively mortifying. The first rule of thumb at any prison is simple and always to be followed. Never, ever call attention to yourself. Kurt Vonnegut wrote, I want to stay as close to the edge as I can without going over. Out on the edge, you can see all kinds of things you cannot see from the center. At heart, I tend to agree, but sometimes edginess can be a bit overwhelming. This was a summer of extreme edginess, from the first hints of a housing crisis to gas prices closing in on $5 a gallon, to our day at the penitentiary, and a car with its own malevolent agenda. In hindsight, it was rather exhilarating, even funny. In action, it was a bit nerve-wracking and tense. The night before we made our prison visit, it was the first time we visited this particular facility, I slept fitfully at a Super 8 motel in a strange city on the Great Plains. My dreams were chaotic and left me with that disquieted feeling we call butterflies. The next morning, in the midst of our agitated silence, while we got ready to leave for the prison, I remember thinking that no matter how it might feel, like butterfly wings fluttering in one's stomach, that we should think of something else to call it. I would have been happy to have some cartoonish but beautiful monarchs or white admirals floating around me rather than this awful feeling that I was about to hurl my breakfast all over the motel room. We ate our breakfast in rigid silence, a hedge against the irritation that comes with nervousness. In the middle of the night, I awoke with the helpless realization that I had not brought along our son's prison number. Knowing the penal system, I readily imagined that the security guards would refuse us entry without it. As it turned out, I wasn't too far off on that point. I panicked, remembering that I had it in a notebook at home 1,000 miles behind me in Reedley. I was reasonably certain that I knew all five numbers, but I could not recall the order. I began the mathematics of rearranging them in all the combinations imaginable before finally ordering myself to stop. You're acting like a crazy woman, I admonished myself. Go back to sleep. I did, and when I awoke with the first chirping of the birds and a glimpse of dawn over the sagebrush-covered plains, the number slipped into place and I wrote it down. I knew I had it right. If ever I needed a good omen, today was the day. 2 days before this, we were smack in the middle of a San Joaquin Valley heat wave, coupled with enough forest fires to make the air dangerous to breathe. The evening newscast, in what seemed to me a bit of absurdity, suggested that there were two ways to escape lung damage from the heat and particles of soot. We could stay inside or leave the valley. And who has the luxury of staying inside? And why would we gas up the car and add to the pollution by driving away from this environmental and medical disaster? We were one of the lucky ones, I suppose. We had planned this trip to see our son, and we would take it despite the soaring gasoline costs. We weren't looking forward to spending the day behind locked doors, but we wanted to see Matthew. The summer had brought other pains for our family. We moved my mother-in-law to a nursing home after 6 months of trying to care for her in her own home. She, understandably, I might add, resisted change, filled the house with her passive anger, and exhausted us with her care. Added to that was the heat, the physical fatigue from closing down our house for sale, and our general emotional weariness. Now here we sat, Doug and I together in our veggie oil-fueled Jetta. We could beat the system in one small way, 1,000 miles from home looking for the prison gate. I hate prisons. I hate prison systems and dynamics. I hate visiting these places and being schlepped about at the whim of a guard, searched, herded, watched. I particularly hate the feeling that someone is following my every move. I despise the dehumanizing aspects of prison, the oversized, shapeless garments prisoners wear for a visit, the culture that expects us to understand it despite gaping holes and wild unpredictability. I hate the inconsistencies and the quirks one must learn to accept, avoid, or attack. I hate the way it makes me feel that we and everyone else here are mere bit actors memorizing a script, playing a role. I hate how the script digs its claws into our skin, overwhelming and controlling us rather than the other way around. If you believe in free will, I suggest that you spend a period of your life connected to a prison. After we get the horn to quit announcing our arrival, we head for the heavy double doors and receive confirmation of the all-seeing eye. Big Brother, that impersonal force with the male voice, greets us from speakers beside the door. Sir? Not sure whether it is talking to us, we pause and look around. There are only two of us at the door, one male, my husband, one female, me. So if it is speaking to us, clearly it is addressing Doug and not me. Sir, you must repark your car over at the edge of the lot beside the white Grand Prix. Do you see the white Grand Prix? Did it really think we would respond? Would it hear us if we did? This disembodied male voice becomes even more mysterious when we are buzzed into the building and see only women until we get on the bus that will take us to Matthew's cell block at the rear of the complex of buildings. After reparking our Jetta by the white Grand Prix and holding our breaths when we lock it again, it doesn't honk this time, we join the women in the crowded entrance who are awaiting Visitor's Day. It is mostly women here to see their husbands, sons, or boyfriends. The only males are my husband Doug, a teenager named Dustin, and a hyperactive 3-year-old boy. The 3-year-old careens between our legs, periodically slapping the handicapped door opener and giggling with his indulgent grandmother, while his mother keeps hissing, "Stop that!" to him. Then we wait. And we wait. The doors are supposed to open at 8 a.m. when we will be permitted to enter the next waiting area, but they don't open until almost 8:15. In the next room, we will register and then line up to wait for the bus to take us to yet another waiting area, the visitation room. There is no hurrying the process. Finish one part, step into the next, wait. Then begin again. Finish, move, wait. While waiting, the chit-chat begins around us with the nearly universal language of parenting. Usually, I tune this stuff out to tamp down my annoyance. Today, however, despite my already raw nerve endings, I listen and find it vaguely mesmerizing, intimately comforting. Dustin, Doug, and I are the only ones not contributing. The young pregnant woman beside me also remains quiet while she shifts uncomfortably from foot to foot. There are no chairs for her to rest. At first, all the talk is directed toward the woman with the infant, who we quickly learn is only 6 weeks old. The talk is beyond the monosyllabic utterances of elevator or checkout line chatter, but it is not the talk among friends. We have something in common, however, and a camaraderie begins to build. It might be ephemeral, but it doesn't lessen the familiarity of it. We are treated to horror stories of childbirth and soon have several opinions on misbehaving kids and discipline. Oh, why are children so difficult today? When I was a kid, I got smacked no matter where we were if I didn't do what my mama said. Yeah, my church even had a spanking room for us. We learned young not to be noisy during the sermon. By the time we get through the doors and into the checkout line, we have moved on to the topics of parole boards, judges, and conspiracy charges. And we have been treated to a lengthy homily from one woman about the absence of evidence in her boyfriend's case. Meanwhile, the disembodied voice emanating from the speakers with our instructions continues to be male, without a male in view. Doug and I hold back, keeping toward the end of the line so that we can determine correct procedures. I hear the receptionist ask for prisoners' numbers and am relieved that I was able to correctly envision Matthew's number after its absence deprived me of much-needed sleep. Before we get to the receptionist, I observe the flip-flops that the young pregnant woman is wearing and conclude that it is her first visit, too. The intake people chastise her and debate what they should do about it. They finally, grudgingly decide she can go in despite her breach. I had pored over the rules of visitation and knew what one could or could not wear, flip-flops were out, and what we could carry in with us, essentially nothing. In her defense, the rules were a bit vague in parts. When I called to clarify one of the finer points, I was advised that, "The brochure can tell you that," by a snippy, gum-chewing voice. She stopped just short of a derisive, "Can't you read?" clearly annoyed by my desire to understand the rules and conform to them. As it turns out, the brochure omitted a few salient points, such as the fact that we could have brought some food for our 8-hour visit to the bowels of the incarceration system. It had to be sealed, but it would have been cheaper and better than the vending machine offerings that we have to buy if we want to eat. Then, too, it is only the seasoned visitors who know how to work the idiosyncratic Debitech machine. We can carry nothing into the visitation room with us, not even money. In order to eat during the day, we will have to buy food from the vending machine if you call a cup of soup or Mars bars food. The vending machines only operate on a Debitech card, which we must purchase from a machine in the lobby after we register for visitation. The brochure had told us that much, but it did not explain the crazy little quirk of the Debitech machine. To use it, you have to put in a $1 bill and get your card. Then you reinsert the card and add money up to $20. If you put the $20 bill in first, it simply disappears, and if you go over $20, you lose it too. Doug and I place our belongings in a locker, retaining a $20 bill for the machine. The flip-flop-wearing pregnant woman also appears at the machine with a $10 bill in hand. Our transient prison visitation community springs into action. The woman who had been chatting about misplaced evidence notices my 20 and stops me. "Wait," she commands, "you'll lose old Andrew Jackson that way." With her explanation, I hurry back to the locker to see if I have a George Washington. No luck, but that's okay. The woman directly behind our first rescuer, Dustin's mother, has a whole stash of wands for precisely this purpose. With a dismissive wave of her hand, she deflects our thanks. "It always happens with new people," she laughs. "I bring lots of wands to hand out to the novices." With the aid of our coaches, we finally get the machine to spit back a card without losing anything. I joke that they should ask the prison to pay them for their services. We all chuckle, and misplaced evidence rolls her eyes. Everything about this place has some difficult-to-navigate idiosyncrasy. They, and I use that dreadful, impersonal they advisedly, one can only speak in vague terms about a decidedly aloof, cold system that passes for our system of justice. They certainly do not make the prison world easy to traverse. I cannot imagine that I will ever feel at ease with any of it. Still, we need and want to be here. The world of walls and locks, security gates and mirrored searches, rooms without windows or access to the sun, ready or not, this has become part and parcel of our world. It is part of our world because we now have a son living on the inside. Before our trip, my anticipation level climbed steadily as I dreamed about crossing 3,000 miles of salt flats, mountains, plains, and prairies that exist between California and Iowa, our furthest destination where we are going for a family reunion. I should have counted the number of people who grimaced and expressed their sympathy that we had to drive all those miles. With a shudder, they would add something like, One time, and only once, did I have to drive across that part of the country. Won't do it again, especially not Nebraska. There's nothing there to see. It's awful. Then they would describe the lengths to which they would go to avoid that drive. Go around it, but they hate Kansas horizons too. Drive through at night. Listening to music and sleeping while someone else drives makes it marginally acceptable. Or, best idea, and they say this with a self-satisfied chuckle, fly over it. Nothing there. I guess that might appear to be true, but that's not how I see it. True, there are no mountains or oceans or forests to fill your senses. It's not Highway 1, looking down steep cliffs to a beach, or the rising of Half Dome, where all you can do is stand in awe. It's just a horizon that stretches forever, waving grasses, an occasional persistent tree, rivers like the Platte that seem more island than river. I would hate to fly over this. Perhaps it's the feeling of loneliness, the sense of ancient footsteps that have been there before me, the deceptive quality and elusive grandeur of the landscape. Mostly, I appreciate the effort it takes to see its beauty. Mountains embrace you. Oceans with their beaches and rock cliffs stand proudly, knowing that you will love them. The prairie just exists and does not care if you like it or not. I like the way it almost thumbs its nose at us, daring us to drive on through, even hoping perhaps that we will not pay attention. When humans pay attention, it seldom bodes well for the landscape. The senses shift on the plains, where your eyes falter, your ears take over. Meadowlark songs filter through the windows even while driving down the interstate. Every chirp of a cricket, every whoosh of my own breath, each sigh that escapes from Doug, nothing deadens the sound, each noise has meaning. You can hear and smell the life and death that has gone on before we arrived to speed through. Any alteration of sound is significant. A sudden stillness, a change in the breeze, the pawing of horses or cows, all indicate a change, a coming catastrophe. This place makes you see more than the immediate landscape. Here you touch history in an abandoned farmstead or a collapsing barn. Standing on a bluff, you can almost hear the ghost herd of buffalo pounding up dust in the distance, or see a native scout apprehensively watching a line of wagons snaking its way along the river. The loneliness only enhances the feeling of the presence of others. Even when a truck rushes past on the interstate, it leaves more than diesel fumes behind. In its wake is a tumbleweed, and silence that veils a thousand voices and cries of joy or pain. For those who believe there is nothing here, they only need to narrowly miss a skunk or spot a western tiger swallowtail, some, unfortunately, on the windshield, for a reminder that to call it nothing belies reality. There are subtle greens of the different types of sagebrush and the occasional comedy when a dead one bounds across the road in front of us. The flowers and grasses have names like rabbit brush, broom snakeweed, or bastard toadflax. There's bottle brush squirreltail, creeping wild rye, yarrow, and evening primrose. There are the white butts of the antelopes to watch for, and an occasional prairie dog, if we're lucky. Dirt and reeds come in every shade of brown, gray, red, or green. This cannot be called nothing when you pay attention. The eccentricity of the beauty, the loneliness that it forces me to face, these are the things that make me beg to cross the prairies, the great plains, and the high deserts as often as I can make the trip. These places have only moderately undulating lines, unlike the wild shapes of mountains or ocean cliffs. The moderation is misleading. Its splendor is not grasped with the same ease of jagged peaks and undisciplined curves. I love to stand beneath Half Dome, to ponder the splendor of Checkerboard Mesa, the Great Smoky Mountains, Niagara Falls, or the Joshua Trees. But I also crave the sharply defined simplicity of Wyoming's Continental Divide Basin or Nebraska's Panhandle, where I can actually touch emptiness and move in silence. In Marilynne Robinson's novel Gilead, the preacher John Ames writes to his son, "Mountains would seem an impertinence from that point of view." There are days, weeks, months when all I can do is pay the bills and do the laundry. There are things in my life that I don't want to do, but I must. There are things that I want to do and cannot find the time or money. There are things I hope to avoid, but when I get to them, they surprise me if I'm willing to slow down. And here on the prairies, I begin to understand the need to pay attention, because in the end, that is the cheapest thrill there is. I cannot afford not to. So I will continue to opt out of flying over the Great Plains every time I can arrange it. As we enter the visitation room, I am a bit apprehensive. If ever I wish I could fly over some experience, this is it. For a fleeting moment, I wish for tomorrow when all the uncertainty will lie behind us. This is an alien system with strange, elusive, even hostile rules, and we must follow the rules if we want to see our son, our wonderful, funny, delightful, if exasperating son whom I have not seen in several years. In the administration building, we are searched. Then there is a bus ride from there to the waiting room of cell block C. Halfway across the compound, we stop for another thorough search, this time of the bus, complete with mirrors, of the under chassis and any place we might have hidden something or someone. Finally, we are at the visitation room where we go through another security gate and, no surprise, we have to wait some more. Either as inmate or visitor, prison is nothing if it is not a waiting game. I alternate between patience, a necessity, and irritation, an inevitability. Even with a lot of patience, the process and system is crazy-making. Without it, an internal hell takes control. We find a table and watch when the door opens, and an inmate emerges in his shapeless visitation gown. The first three men are obviously not Matthew. One is toting an oxygen machine. The second quickly heads for the woman and the baby. The third one has an unrecognizable swagger. As the next one enters, my heart sinks. Is he never coming? I draw in my breath and watch the fourth inmate saunter across the room. It isn't until he chuckles and begins to talk that I realize that this is Matthew. It has been too long. All I can do is hug him and try to keep from crying. I cannot let go. In 3 years, he has changed a lot. His overalls are tight at the waist, hiding most of him, but he's a man now, not a boy. His hair is long and neatly combed. In the end, it is his grin that gives him away. "Hey, Mom," he chuckles, "you didn't know me, did you?" I hold him for another moment before we sit down to begin our 8-hour sojourn together. "I was afraid you might not make it this morning and would have to wait until noon to come in," he tells us. "I didn't get dressed because I was afraid that might jinx it." "You would have to wait until 1 o'clock, you know. They won't just let you in any time." We know that. This information was in the brochure and was yet another part of our anxiety this morning. Would we make it in time? One of the men gets up from another table and comes toward us, carrying the 6-week-old infant we had met in the lobby. "Hey, Matt," he grins, holding out his armload. "Meet my daughter, Kayla." Matt gets up and peers down into the blanket holding Kayla. "This is my daughter," the guy says again with a bemused grin, as if he can hardly believe it himself. Matt talks to the child a moment before his friend wanders back to his wife. "I love babies," Matt tells us. "Glad I don't have any, though. It would be too hard to be a dad and be in this place, but I sure like kids." Matt has created a bit of a career for himself, if it can be called such. His way of earning money while on the inside is drawing for other inmates. For me, too. On Mother's Day, he sent me a finely penciled drawing of a bouquet of roses. Here, inmates bring him a photo and Matt will draw their families and friends. In Kayla's first month, her dad had commissioned Matt to create likenesses of his newborn daughter. Kayla's dad paid him for them and mailed the prints to his wife. In the photo right after she was born, Matthew tells us, she had her eyes open and they were dilated and kind of funny. "I drew a picture and she looked just like a little alien." He laughs and continues, "She was even holding her fingers out like this." He demonstrates with a Vulcan salute. It was funny, both the way she looked and my drawing of her. Her family loved it. With that, Matthew and Doug plunge into a discussion of artists and art history, one of Matthew's favorite topics. He is particularly interested in Goya, Saturn eating his children, but with Doug's prompting, branches out into other artists and other eras. Salvador Dali also catches his attention. Matthew shares with us his knowledge of some modern illusionists, artists whose names we've never heard before. And then we begin the process of catching up with each other while we sit around a game table in a prison visitation room. At times we just grin at each other. I reach out to touch him, his arm, his cheek. He's not a child anymore, and I try to refrain. Matthew notices my hesitation and laughs. It's okay, he tells me. I really don't mind. I usually call him Matthew now, but once I revert to his 8-year-old pet name, Matty. Before I complete my apology, Matthew lays his hand on my arm and assures me once again that he doesn't mind. Even in the first hour, he seems to be reassuring me a lot. I feel the clamping in my chest, the dampness of my eyes. It is no longer the dreadful little butterflies of anticipation, but the pure joy of the present. Here I sit in this god-awful place with my son, whom I haven't seen in 3 years, whose entire adult life has been spent behind locked doors. And even so, I feel inexplicably, utterly elated. I wish this day could drag on forever. Matthew has always had this effect on me, where most people see a compulsive kleptomaniac who generates chaos and turmoil, I see Matthew, my brilliant, delightful son. I have felt the results of his chaos in our lives, experienced his childhood meltdowns, endured periods when I needed Prozac to survive. I have lost and regained hope more times than I want to count. And still he makes me smile. About 4 or 5 months after Matthew came to live with us when he was 8 years old, he had a period of extreme tantrums of fear and anger. Every morning and evening, something would trigger it. Shoes that felt too tight. Not being allowed to get the mail. Merely walking out the door in the morning. He would remove his shoes, tear off his clothes, strip down to his underwear while we held him. Our reassurances fell on deaf ears, but eventually we would get him reclothed and into the car, hoping that the neighbors would not think we were abusing him and call Child Protective Services. This was our daily procedure for almost 4 months. After one particularly horrendous week, when I ended up in therapy myself, we decided to see a video on Friday night. Although I don't remember, I can safely bet that it was the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, since that was his only choice at the time. Matthew and I walked through our apartment complex and between the hedgerows to the video store. Upon leaving the video store, we decided to swing by the grocery store before heading home. On the sidewalk between the two establishments, Matty held out his hand in front of me saying, "Wait, Mom." I stopped, not sure what might be coming. Holding his breath, he paused at my side, then turned 3 perfectly executed cartwheels down the sidewalk in front of me, skipped back and took my hand. "I feel so much better now, Mom. I think we'll make it through the weekend." It was the first laugh I had in weeks, and a full-belly chortle exploded out of me while I hugged him. No matter how rough life gets, Matthew always makes me laugh. While watching Matthew and Doug hunched over the chess set promising each other a sound beating, I can almost touch the serenity. As the day proceeds, the feeling deepens and I settle into it, even after I see what he has done to his tongue. From time to time, we make a trip to the machines for a Coke or some chips. In between, we begin a jigsaw puzzle and keep talking. Matthew was the only one in our family who would join me in my obsession with puzzles, and it's a great way to spend the day while we learn what's going on in each other's lives. We're almost halfway through our day before we see his tongue. I don't think he planned to show us, and once he does, I ask him not to show me again. During a lull, he turns toward me and bares his teeth, shoving his tongue through the gaps, revealing his newest creativity and body art. We have already been granted a look at the faint, half-finished tattoo that covers his forearm. He made it, as inmates do, with whatever he had available. Guitar wire, a small homemade motor, and soot. I stop him before he provides more details. But the tongue. What can I say to that? It's hardly the worst thing he's done to himself, but I still cannot stomach it. With a penknife, he made a small slit in the front end so that it is forked. He finds it amusing. I don't. Body art. I can hardly believe I'm gracing it with that name. To call it mutilation is not quite accurate either, but a bit closer in my opinion. Running the gamut of topics from the mundane, daily routine, food, to the substantial, what's happening in the presidential campaign, matters of faith, Matthew remembers an encounter he had with a minister. We get lots of preacher types in here. I don't see the chaplain much, though he's pretty cool, but these other guys come in and talk to us. He looks at us and grins. You won't believe what this one guy had the audacity to tell me. He told me that maybe it's God's will that I'm in here. Matthew knows our response to this one. This jackass stood there in my face telling me that God wants me here. I told him exactly how stupid I thought that line of reasoning was, and then he added something even dumber. He said, well, maybe God intended that you meet me, and that's why he put you here. We chuckle a little. Matthew never could stomach irrationality or stupidity in adults. He irritated more teachers with facts that he researched, facts that contradicted what they had told the class the day before. It was easy to anticipate what he might have said to a minister who talked to him about God's will. I looked him in the eye and asked him if he really believed that God wanted me to burglarize those homes, take all that stuff from those people, mess up their lives and mine, just so that I could come to this hellhole and meet him. I told him that it was me. Matt emphasizes the word me by jabbing a finger into his chest and repeats, me. I put myself in this place. No one else, including God Almighty, wanted me to do it. He shakes his head and adds, what kind of screwed up theology makes people believe that kind of stuff? And isn't it a bit arrogant of him to think that meeting him would be so important that God would stop all she needs to do in this crazy world to take the time to put me here? He threw in the she for my benefit. Matthew gives a bit of a snort and flips his hair out of his eyes, staring at us as if daring someone to contradict him. We disagree with him on many things, but not this. Later in the day, we have a lengthy conversation about Matt's need to teach himself when to shut up and not say everything that he thinks, even when he might be right. In this case, however, I am glad that he can think logically and speak his mind to people who believe they have absolute truth on their side. Before we know it, we have talked our way through 8 hours. With a jolt, I realize that I am no longer aware of the lack of windows and daylight in the room, or that someone is watching us at all times. We are still locked in and can leave only at certain pre-appointed hours, but we have eased our way into another new experience. When I stop to think about it, it is still surreal, but it is now just another day in our lives. We gear up to say goodbye and watch Matthew's back as he leaves the visitation room. I catch my breath to hold in the pain of knowing that it will be another year before we see each other. On the other side of the door, Matthew will have to strip down for a search while we exit through the opposite door, go through a scanner, and get back on the bus. The bus will again be searched with mirrors several times on our ride back to the administration building. And so ends our day with Matthew. 45 minutes later, we are back in the car on the interstate. Fortified by cappuccinos, we stare silently at the sagebrush and antelopes that sprint gracefully across the seemingly bare hills, with the sun sinking behind us, leaving magenta streaks in its wake. We are looking forward to a late dinner at Sweet Melissa's, the best vegetarian restaurant west of the Mississippi River. The stillness, unlike the agitation of the silence that preceded our visit, is satisfied and relaxed. I hear a sigh and realize that it came from me. Doug exhales in reply, and our communication is complete. The prairies and plains are places that are larger than life. Long horizons, big sky, ever-present wind, killer snowstorms, with all the expansive emotions to accompany the immensity. I think of the stories of women who went insane on these plains, the attempts, many of which failed, to forge harmony between peoples, natives and newly arrived immigrants, sheep farmers and ranchers, miners and cattle barons. I recall my own childhood family vacations when we crossed these plains, heading for regular visits with my dad's family in Oregon. For me, this particular landscape conjures up all these images of corporate and personal history in ways that no other landscape does. There is nothing halfway or moderate here, only extremes. There is nothing normal in its beauty. It hovers at the edge of most people's consciousness and desire. That is the beauty and the pain of memory, whether private or collective. At the end of the day, I realize that I thrive on the discomfort that comes from being in places I might not choose if I'm given the option, such as waiting in a cold lobby alongside people I don't normally associate with, and finding delight in a barren landscape. There is a largesse that accompanies this grandeur, and it is here on the plains and in the prison where life's generosity is uncovered. This is not just about the thrill of living on the edge. It is so much more than that. This is about noticing who sets the definitions and who prescribes the notions that we hold as truth. It is about paying attention to the elusive details and about helping each other muddle through. It is about feeling the moments of goodness that connect all the most mundane, bland, or difficult things in life. It's about seeing normal in your rearview mirror and being only slightly surprised by the realization that you don't even want to make a U-turn anymore.
That, friends, was Hope Knisely reading her story with Normal in My Rearview Mirror. Right from the beginning, we realize that the woman telling the story and her husband are traveling all the way from Reedley to Wyoming to visit someone in prison. Not exactly my idea for a great vacation. Things get even more anxious when we find out that the person they're visiting is their son, Matthew, whom they haven't seen in 3 years. We realize, of course, that all those embarrassing and humiliating security measures they put visitors through at prisons, all the waiting and searching, are, of course, necessary, although they can't be very pleasant. And then we get to meet Matthew, who, in spite of having tattooed his arms and carved up his tongue, seems to be fairly upbeat about his situation. What's especially hopeful is that he seems to understand that he really has nobody to blame, especially God, for the situation he's in other than himself. Well, all we can hope for is, one, that as parents, this kind of situation never happens to any of us, and two, that Matthew will be able to rehabilitate himself and be able to live a normal, crimeless existence. Before we leave the subject, please know that as of today, there are 2,311,000 Americans incarcerated in federal, state, local prisons and jails. Without a doubt, most of them do have living relatives. Thank you, Hope Knisely, for a really riveting story. If you're any kind of parent, it's a story that's bound to make an impression on you. Friends, Hope Knisely lives in Reedley. We've had her on the program before, and we're always inspired by her fine writing. We hope she's getting another story ready for us for next year. And so we come to the end of another edition of Valley Writers Read. Thank you for tuning in. If you'd like to listen to tonight's or any other Valley Writers Read program, just go online at kvpr.org. and link up with archived audio. Next week, our writer reader will be C.B. Mosier. In the meantime, this is your host, Franz Weinschenk, wishing you and yours a great life story until we meet again. Good night.
Valley Writers Read is a production of Valley Public Radio, produced by Don Weaver and Franz Weinschenk. Please join us again next Wednesday at 7 p.m. for another edition of Valley Writers Read.